Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, that is. And today, I'm so excited to get to this topic here. But we're going to talk about, can the Democrats find their way out of the political wilderness? And one important aspect of that is, can they find their way back into the good graces of working class voters? As listeners know, that's a key demographic that the Democrats have had going back to their New Deal coalition in the Franklin Roosevelt era, and they've been losing working class voters of all races and ethnicities, especially over the last 10 years here. Well, I've got a special guest here who I'm looking forward to discussing this with. She's been a guest before. Her name is Joan Williams, and she teaches at the University of California, San Francisco, in San Francisco. And she's an expert on class dynamics, which is, as somebody from a working class household as I am, I find this very fascinating. She's just written a book that's called Outclassed: How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. And Joan, I'm looking forward to our discussion. Thank you for taking the time.
I'm looking forward to it too, Robin. It's a delight to be here again.
Yeah. What led you to write this book? You wrote a book called White Working Class. And again, I had you as a guest. And here we are back talking about, it seems like, the same thing. And not much has been done. Nobody really, I think, listened to you before. Unfortunately, I think for the Democrats anyway, but what led you to produce this book?
Well, I started writing this when I brought together a working group of people who I thought their research was really going to be the path forward for Democrats. And I brought them together to one meeting, and I realized, no one's really putting this together quite the way that I'm putting it together. I've worked on race, class, and gender for like 45 years, Robin. And what I was a little disheartened is that the people who focused on gender just focused on gender, and the people who focused on race just focused on race. And the people who focused on class all too often were just talking about the need to center white working class men. And that's an important group, but it's only one group, and understanding class dynamics is a bit more complicated than just putting white working class men at the center. So I thought, well, we have, at that point, we had like, we were looking at Trump being the nominee again. And I thought, either I, as a Democrat, I'm going to lose, or we're just going to scrape by. And both of those outcomes are completely unacceptable to me. And I got to try to do something.
So let me ask you this. Did this phenomenon of working class voters shifting to the Republicans, did it start before Trump? Was it a phenomenon where he brought these working class voters to him?
No, Trump is just a symptom. Started way before Trump. And of course, it's a very similar dynamic, both in Europe and the US. And what the research in political science has shown is that for decades, the mainstream parties didn't really offer the package that one particular group of voters wanted. These are non-college educated voters. and they hold progressive economic views, but often pretty conservative cultural views. And what that's what political scientists actually call the representation gap, that group of voters was not being represented until the far right rose and represented them.
This was a case of the Democrats, as you say in the title, the left, losing these voters. Was it a case, too, of the Republicans, and then when Trump came along, gaining them? Or is it a distinction without a difference?
Well, there's been a peel-off of working class voters, first white working class voters, and now increasingly Latinos and even other working non-college voters peeling away from Democrats. Some of them just stopped voting, but many of them have started voting Republican. Republicans understood that they were going to have to forge a coalition. I think this, Robin, is really where it all started. The sort of the merchant right, the economic elites in this country, they realized that non-college voters weren't automatically going to vote for them. And so they realized they were going to have to make some trade-offs and forge a coalition with these voters. And the coalition initially was, okay, we'll give you your cultural issues on things like abortion rights. And in return for, and you'll vote for us because of our conservative cultural, we'll adopt those conservative cultural values. But once we get into office, we'll do what we want to do as economic elites. Then Trump came in and he disrupted that a little bit, didn't he? He said he was going to defend Medicare and Social Security, which was a big, big shift. And he talked about working class jobs. He talked about bringing back factory jobs. He channeled that anger against trade policy, where you had a lot of people who felt like their jobs had closed down, their factories had closed down in the United States, and they had gone abroad, and that Democrats hadn't done anything about it, and Republicans hadn't done anything about it, and they were fed up. So what Trump did is he put together the respect for conservative social values, but he embraced the economic, the liberal economic values and workers' rights language that Republicans traditionally hadn't embraced. And that has proved the explosively effective package.
Do you feel, and I've this has been a major, this topic's been a major focus of my show since I started back in 2015. Do you think this is more of a policy problem for Democrats, or is this a messaging problem for Democrats? And I want to, right after this, I want to get to my favorite chapter in your book.
It's both. It's very popular. Democrats have spent so much money addressing this as just a messaging problem. If we have the right values, we have the right policies, we just need to message things differently. And there's really an element to truth to that. They do need to message things differently. First of all, Democrats very often use a very specific set of talk traditions that are particular to college graduates, and often they don't even know it. They use fancy talk. They talk about abstract, multi-part, Stacey Abrams calls them overstuffed policy manifestos. They have what I call the Rachel Maddow style of, like, I'm an intelligent person talking to you, an intelligent person, about complex matters. That is a very specific cultural style, peculiar, that offers social honor to college grads, talking to other college grads. It's heard as off-putting and condescending to people who are non-college grads. They prefer a very different speaking style. Direct, authentic, unvarnished. Trump doesn't sugarcoat things, said one Trump voter. Trump speaks this more working class style tradition. So that's a messaging point, and that's something that Democrats need to learn. Unfortunately, a lot of the electeds already know it, but they feel they need to continue to use that more elite style to reach their core, which is now college-educated progressives. So college-educated progressives need to understand that this is a specific cultural style that's going to lose them elections. So that's the first messaging point. The second messaging point is that very often the way that Democrats have talked about issues that are very cherished by their key voters, like climate change, have completely failed to connect with non-college grads, and especially non-college grads in the heartland, who are often very dissatisfied, number one, because they're non-college grads, and non-college grads have not fared well in this economy for the past decades. And number two, neoliberalism that really ate out the stability of the American middle class also concentrated nearly all of the growth into a few megastar cities and left a lot of areas left behind. And that also is something that people in the heartland can't get over, nor should they. It's not fair. It's not appropriate. But college grads tend to focus, their third highest priority is climate change. But how do they often talk about climate change? They say anybody who doesn't agree with them is a climate denier. That is a perfect example of how Democrats are helping reinforce the far right's script that elites are looking down on you. That is just like a boneheaded move, with all respect. And to quote the protesters in France, they said, we care more about the end of the month than the end of the world. We can't think about the end of the world. We're too worried about the end of the month. And so their messaging of climate change has to be respectful of that reality and has to tie into values that people, working class people and people in the heartlands, hold. For example, the rootedness and the pride in their local communities. How about using farmers to say, I can't grow the crops that my grandfather used to grow on this land. The hunting has completely changed because the animal populations have completely changed because of these extreme weather conditions. How about talking about the fact that, ordinary middle-class people who have spent their entire lives saving for their houses now see their houses burning down or getting flooded because of extreme weather? And, who's going to be left holding the bag? It's not the big insurance companies, because they're refusing anymore often to insure these houses, or they underinsure them. It's ordinary middle-class people are going to be left holding the bag. So it's not that hard to message. You notice I haven't even used climate change. I've used extreme weather. It's not that hard to message climate change in a way that connects with people's everyday experience, but people often don't do that because they're so busy calling people climate deniers and talking about a zero fossil fuel future. But it's not, as you point out, just messaging. And I bet you're going to talk next about gay marriage.
As soon as I give a quick promo here, just for our listeners, you're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson. We're about halfway through my interview with Joan Williams. We're talking about her new book called Outclassed: How the Left Lost the Working Class, How to Win Them Back. It's a fascinating book for everybody, really, to read about what's going on in our country. Progressives, Democrats, yeah, but I think people just generally interested in politics would find this very interesting. There's a lot here to learn. I was going to go to that, but I think what Let's talk about that. Let's go right into that since you brought it up, and I'll come back to a couple other things here in my notes and my favorite chapter. So talk about gay marriage, and you devote a chapter in your book to that, and again, how to effectively message on that.
Yeah, the gay marriage example is so important because that is really, for progressives, the key victory they've had in my lifetime, my long lifetime. And so I went and interviewed one of the chief architects of that campaign. And when he started, we were both remembering that gay marriage was not a priority for the gay liberation movement. Their priority was to make the world safe for a wide range of sexualities and relationships. And he, as part of that, he and other advocates had passed the domestic partnership law in California. And the Alameda County court clerk out here had arranged a party for the first day that people could come and get hitched. And she had tables with heart balloons, and she organized a big procession down a grand staircase. And the person I was talking to, this architect of the gay marriage strategy, said, you know, I've suddenly got it. I saw people coming down the stairs, and I realized that this was the prom and the wedding ceremony and everything rolled into one. And they could finally say, yeah, Mom, I got married. What he realized at that point was that marriage was really, really important. He said, these people aren't doctors, weren't doctors and lawyers. These were ordinary, average people. And what he was tapping into is that non-elites tend to gain social honor in different way that elites do, through religion, through the military, or through traditional family values. Mom, I got married. And what he realized was that this is what, to quote him, this is what our people wanted. They wanted marriage. And then he held focus groups and he changed messaging. He changed messaging from equal rights, which is what appealed to his base, to commitment, which is what appealed to, quote, our people. But the only reason, Robin, that he could change messaging was because he changed priorities. He looked at what ordinary average people wanted. He didn't say, okay, only 24% of Americans support gay marriage, so I'm not going to advocate for gay marriage. But he, in order to advocate effectively and respectfully for gay marriage, he connected with the moral intuitions of ordinary average people and was respectful of that in setting priorities. So what Democrats need to do is, number one, they need to talk like ordinary people talk. And number two, they need to understand everyday people's values and connect with them. But number three, they need to be respectful in setting liberal priorities, respectful of the values of ordinary people, if they want to win and if they want to be kind of decent citizens that are respectful of their fellow citizens.
I think you hit on it right there, just the language and how, I'll say not just Democrats, but all politicians talk anymore. I've been involved in campaigns. I'm sure you know how it works, where pollsters go out, poll people, they put language in. If it tests well, that's the language that the politicians keep repeating. That language is put together by people with college degrees out on the coast for the most part. It's not how average people talk. And I can see it. I mean, and I think the average voter can see it now. I don't think it's an accident that Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders both did very well with these voters, because they talk, yes, like you just said. I would be shocked if either had a pollster telling them you need to say this or that, or if they did, they didn't listen.
And they both come across as very authentic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how do you see evidence that there's more candidates out there that have shaken loose of the traditional method and just talk like normal people do? Because I think I agree with you 100%. I think this is a huge opportunity, but I just don't, I got to confess, I don't see it a lot yet.
I actually see, as a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, I see a lot of talent in the Democratic Party. I see a lot of talented people coming up who know how to talk to people. I do. I think that I think, frankly, this is a particular challenge for women, because women have to be super, super careful to be both authoritative and nice, and they have to be so careful that they often come across as inauthentic. But look at Gretchen Whitmer, fix the damn roads.
Right.
Concrete, unvarnished, very direct, not that hard.
Yeah, I agree. All right, I got to get in. We've got time here. My favorite chapter is chapter 19, talking across class lines, because it gets into language and how we talk to each other. And I have to bring this up, how talk about food and leisure are class codes. It's like bingo. Could you expound on that a little bit, please?
Yeah. I call it the class structure of coffee. I mean, when I was coming up in the 1960s, a cup of coffee was a cup of coffee, right? It was either good or bad. That was it. Now, oh my lordy me, the coffee that you drink tells you so much about you. I mean, my crowd won't even go near Starbucks. Oh, God forbid. We have to go to a single bean, artisanal, non-corporate, you name it. That is just a way of displaying social capital. That is displaying that you're classy, as opposed to, you know, a flavored coffee from Dunkin' Donuts, for example. I'm now showing my cards as a former Easterner. Food. So Democratic politicians have gotten into trouble about food. I think it was Michael Dukakis who was called a latte drinking. You know, there it is. Class structure of coffee. John Kerry, way back when, he had this campaign photo of him doing windsurfing. He thought he was so edgy and so cool and so with it. People looked at that and go like, are you kidding me? Windsurfing. How about pick up soccer? How about, you know, baseball? So leisure is very class linked. Body type is very class linked. Food is very class linked. Even what you drink, we have I would really, really urge your listeners to go to classbubblequiz.com and take our little 10 question quiz. And one of the questions it asks is, what kind of beer would you bring to a party? That also is very class linked.
Oh, yes.
And I think that in the United States, we like to think that we're not a class, we're a classless society. And oh my goodness, I wish we were a classless society, but oh my goodness, we are not a classless society.
The big issue that's come up, and you devote, I believe, a chapter to this as well, is masculinity. And we've got, you know, obviously the gender divide, which has just been getting more and more extreme, with more women favoring Democrats and men favoring Republicans. But the Democrats' answer, as I'm sure you saw here a couple months ago, was to spend $20 million, hire consultants, and figure out why young men are voting against Democrats. That seems like it's the perfect, that's the way Democrats do things, is hire a bunch of consultants to tell them, which I really hope they get away from, because I don't think that's the way to go. But anyway, without me editorializing, you talk about how the Democrats need to develop their own brand of masculinity. Can you get into that a little bit, please?
Yeah, I mean, here I am in San Francisco, a San Francisco progressive. And we really have to get over the situation where liberals are ceding masculinity to the far right. It is not working for us. Masculinity is a cherished identity for most men. Around 70% of men say they meet with more social approval if they behave in masculine ways. And men, in particular, one of the most cherished masculine roles is being a provider. And, you know, wages of in the United States would be 43% higher, Robin, if wages had continued to keep pace with productivity as they did in the decades after World War II. So a lot of non-college men can no longer fulfill that cherished provider role. And one of the results is that many of them have turned to another very cherished masculine role, that of the protector. So if you're talking about gun rights, you're talking about masculinity. As unemployment rises, so do requests for gun permits. And just to say, as my crowd sometimes does, oh, well, we don't want to go there because masculinity is toxic and we believe in a gender-neutral future. I actually kind of do believe in a gender-neutral future in the sense that I would like more people to have more freedom to express themselves in a wide variety of ways. But the way, if you want that, the solution is not to keep losing elections. That is not helping. And Republicans are going to be tapping into honored forms of masculinity, and Democrats need to be tapping into honored forms of masculinity as well, by expressing respect for honorable forms of masculinity, of which there are many. You know, there are some lame forms of masculinity, there's some lame forms of femininity, there's some lame forms of everything. But there are very honorable elements that are part of the masculinity package. And there are a variety of ways that Democrats can do this. John Fetterman, who, of course, now is having really tough sledding, and I know we all feel for him, but he performs a form of masculinity which is the same as what Trump does, and for that matter, Bernie does. It's called bad but bold masculinity. And so that can be done on the left, that can be done on the right, but there's also, decent honorable man masculinity of like, I'm not gonna stoop down there because I'm a leader in the community and a leader in my family. And I'm going to be respectful. I'm going to be appropriate. I'm going to be responsible. Who are we not talking about here, Robin?
I've got time for one more question. I got 30 seconds. Who are some other people you mentioned, Gretchen Whitmer, John Fetterman, or some other people especially that are talking the right language for Democrats? If you've got two or three other examples here in about 30 seconds.
Ruben Gallego, who run in a largely red district, talks about the importance of hard work. Greg Cesar, who won in Colorado, also talks in a way that is very straightforward and connects with very straightforward, widely held values. So those are a few people.
Thank you so much for being my guest today on Heartland Politics. Joan Williams, the author of Outclassed, How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back.
Thank you so much. I so much appreciate the invitation. It's always fun to talk to you, Robin.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at wvik.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.